Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this special follow-up webinar, which is an interdisciplinary case study panel discussion brought to you by the Mental Health Professionals Network. Some of you might not know who they are, but they're a not-for-profit organisation contracted by the Commonwealth Government Department of Health and Ageing, and their role is to essentially make available to roll out interdisciplinary mental health workshops right across Australia. And the idea is that we're going to create sustainable, self-supported clinical networks. And the object of this webinar is, first of all, to identify discipline-specific approaches to the diagnosis, the treatment, and management of adolescent mental health presentations, with particularly a feature of depression, suicidality, and maybe even cyberbullying. And secondly, to recognise the ways in which mental health interdisciplinary collaboration will obviously contribute to a better patient outcome. Now, the session outline is really quite simple. The webinar will be composed of two separate parts. The first will be a facilitated case study panel discussion. The second will be an opportunity for you as webinar viewers to ask questions and obviously receive answers. We will only go for an hour and a half, but in this time the panel will share with you discipline-specific tips and strategies for working with our client tonight, whose name is Tim, and obviously field questions from the audience. So I warmly welcome all of you who have logged on. You've obviously shown interest and commitment to adolescent health because you've allocated time out from your busy schedule to watch this webinar live, and we're very, very appreciative, particularly because we know it clashes with home and away, and we appreciate the sacrifice that you're making. So as you know, this is a follow-up webinar to the first one, and today the focus will be on you getting some specific tips and strategies from the panel about working with adolescents with this type of presentation. I'm particularly pleased to be able to welcome some new panel members and even a new discipline in the form of a mental health nurse practitioner who you'll meet later. In order to appreciate this webinar in 3D and Technicolor with surround sound, please ensure that your sound is in fact activated on your computer and the volume is turned up. During the webinar, I would encourage you all to post questions by typing them into the message box. Now, sadly, given the amount of participants, we may not have time for your specific question to be addressed, but you can always participate in a post-webinar forum to continue the discussion. Please note that the PowerPoints from this particular slideshow will be available as a resource on the Mental Health Professionals Network website, which is www.mhpn.org.au. Needless to say, any inappropriate questions will not be presented. And I'm going to moderate the panel discussion tonight, and my name is Michael Carr-Gregg, and I'm also going to moderate the question and answer sessions. So, to the case study. And this is the most important part, I guess. We will have online for you to see and hear several people, and I'm going to introduce them as they come online. So the first thing I want to say is it's true today that the majority of young people in Australia are no longer grossly malnourished. They're not shoved down coal mines or up chimneys, but they nevertheless face psychological pressures, anxieties and tensions which really are without precedent. Many of our clients, our patients, are growing up in a psychological wasteland without nurturing or support, growing up in circumstances of pervasive adversity and limited resources such that their developmental trajectories are certain to be irretrievably compromised. 75%, as you can see, of all mental illnesses begin before the age of 25. One in four of these kids obviously can have a mental health problem. and only 30% seek professional help. The truth is that mental health disorders now account for 49% of the disease burden, and that is significant, measured as both death and disability, or 55% if you believe the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare. Young Australians appear to be suffering mental health problems at an earlier age than before, experiencing them at higher rates than older age groups, and retaining their increased risk beyond youth into older age. So I guess this is timely, and I would be I'm delighted to introduce to you the subject of our case study tonight, who is in fact a 17-year-old year 11 student. He doesn't particularly want to seek help. He's not a particularly sophisticated consumer of health services, let alone mental health services. So he's not particularly keen to be there. He's been brought along for an assessment by his mum, and she thinks he's irritable, argumentative, and is worried about his poor academic performance. There's no previous history, but he does seem to be a sensitive lad. The family history basically is a mother who's tense, a father who was a heavy drinker, and of course, a paternal uncle who has bipolar disorder. When you talk to him, Tim basically thinks his mother is sort of the Wicked Witch of the West. There's some tension with Dad, some tension with a particular school teacher. Significantly, there was a recent falling out with his friends. He doesn't appear to have much of an interest in schools, doesn't really have much of a sense of the future, and complains of being tired a lot of the time. So he is, in fact, the next patient of yours, Mary, and I'm interested to know what you're going to do.
Well, thanks. Can I just check that you can hear me on speaker, because I can pick the phone up if necessary?
I can, but before you do that, I'm just going to introduce you, Mary. You are a GP and you're a psychotherapist and you work at Headspace Townsville. You have a mixed role as a senior clinician, and that includes seeing clients for medical, psychological medicine and psychotherapy appointments. You are also making a very strange noise.
It was me. My phone was about to lose battery, so I was going to lose you all. I'm sorry.
That's all right. So you're a very experienced GP in working at Headspace, which is a national initiative with 30 centres around Australia, and is one of the Townsville General Practice Network programs. And you actually work there with five other doctors at Headspace. I believe you work 4 days a week, so you're a very good person to tell us how you are going to deal with young Tim.
Thank you for that, Michael. I'll try and live up to it. So I guess the other thing I'd like to say is that a number of my points are, in fact, the same as some of the other presenters later, so I'm not going to labour those ones because I think there's more erudite presentations coming up. But one of the key things is engagement with young people, and I think GPs often struggle because of our time constraints. So I'm aware that I have a luxurious position where I can take an hour for an initial appointment with a young person. But even if you don't have an hour, you need to give young people the sense that you are genuinely interested in them. And they do, if I'm allowed to say, they do have a pretty finely tuned bullshit meter. And so I'm from North Queensland, so I apologise for that. If they sense that you're not genuine, they are not going to tell you anything. So I guess the key thing is to be really genuinely interested. It's a little bit delicate sometimes. In this case, mum's brought Tim in, so mum's going to want to say some things to you as well. With a 17-year-old, I would generally see them both together first for a few minutes, and then I'd see Tim on his own. And I generally wouldn't see mum on her own unless Tim had already consented to that. Now, there's somebody else is going to talk about the HEDS assessment, but I think it's a really good model for approaching adolescents. So the things that you would talk about first are less challenging. So who do you live with? what grade are you in at school, what subjects do you like, what don't you like, and then you work towards the things like sexual relationships and drug use, and then I wrote death, but, you know, suicide, self-harm. I think GPs, or doctors in general, are trained to cut to the chase because we've got such a short time. So, you know, we want to know what the presenting complaint is and sort it out and get them out the door generally in 10 or 15 minutes. And if we go straight to those sort of questions with a young person, they probably won't answer them. So I find the HEDS assessment a really useful model, and it doesn't have to take an hour. You can get used to it. I'm just changing the slide. So I won't continue with the HEDS assessment because someone else is going to talk about that some more. I did want to mention about self-harm and suicide risk. I think we've all got fairly good at asking the screening questions, but I think sometimes if people say yes, doctors tend to panic because we think that we're going to have to do something or we're going to have to fix it. But my experience has been that it's often worth actually asking quite a lot more, and the young person having permission to talk about their suicidal ideation, maybe plans or previous attempts, but to actually talk a little bit more, or quite a lot more in fact, about, you know, when it's happened, what have they been feeling like beforehand, how did they feel after, because it's a topic that people find so difficult to talk about. It's probably the one thing that mum is most worried about and will panic the most if she has any sense that Tim's at risk of harming himself or killing himself. And so he's probably learnt not to talk about it. So for us to give him the chance to talk about it is can be very, very valuable. With engagement, I think it's important, even if he didn't want to come, there's probably something that he can recognise might be valuable for him to address. So he might actually be really distressed about those relationships at school that have broken down or with his mates, and he might actually be quite pleased to talk about that. So I guess my approach is to try and find out what's important to him, and that's what we focus on. GPs are probably, most of the ones on this webinar anyway, would be pretty used to writing general practice mental health treatment plans. And one of the things that we have to do there is look at goal setting. And I've found that a really useful question is, it actually comes out of solution-focused therapy. But the question is, how will you know it's been helpful? So if I refer you to a psychologist, or you take a course of this medication, or we make a lifestyle intervention, or all of the above, how will you know it's been helpful? What will be different? And I find that they're often able to come up with quite specific things then, rather than just, I want to be happy. And then the final thing, which will be covered again later, is that medication is not always first line. In fact, it's usually not the first line in depression, and particularly in young people. There's not an awful lot of evidence for very many of the drugs and their effectiveness, and there is a lot of evidence for other things. So I think it's worth remembering that it's not first line. That can be really difficult for GPs, especially if you're in a small country town and you don't have a visiting psychologist or a counsellor or anybody else that you can really refer this young person to. I guess my point there is also not to underestimate the value of your own interaction with that young person. So sometimes if you're able to say, look, I understand that things have been really hard for you. I'm pleased that you've been able to come and have the courage to talk about it. And I think that it'll be important for us to see each other regularly. If you're able to make an appointment to see them once a week, even for 20 minutes, how's things going, what's happened in the last week, sometimes that can actually be enough, because you're an objective kind of listener. You don't have to know any magic counselling skills. You just have to be safe and respectful. And I think that that's often not valued enough, that the GP can... I guess for the young person, because the doctor is feeling that they're important enough to make time for, sometimes that in itself can be really helpful. So, you know, often there's a lot more than that is needed, but if you're in a small place and you're it, don't be scared, because I think sometimes you're actually enough. So I think they were my points.
Well done, and plenty of time to spare. Other panel members, even though I haven't introduced you individually, do you have any comments or questions about what has just been said? No, they're all absolutely in awe. Well, that's fantastic. All right, well then I'll move on to our next presenter, Simon Kinsella. Dr. Kinsella is a Melbourne-based clinical psychologist with over 17 years of experience. He actually completed his PhD researching the links between family conflict, family functioning, and life satisfaction. He was a senior clinical psychologist at the Austin Health Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service and in the Adolescent Day Patient Program at the Albert Road Centre for Health. Currently Simon works full-time in private practice where he consults children, adolescents, families and adults. He's also an honorary fellow in the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the University of Melbourne. He holds statutory positions as an independent medical examiner and as a panellist for the Disciplinary Review Board, and is also the current chair of the Victorian State Committee of the Australian Psychological Society and the chairman of the Melbourne branch of the Australian Psychological Society. So he's eminently well qualified to talk about the psychologist's perspective on a young man like him. Over to you.
Thank you, Michael. I guess in reading the case study, one thing that really stands out to me is the value of the information that the GP has already gathered. That information about the reluctance of Tim and the anxiety of the mother and her desire to be involved in the process is really critical from my point of view in terms of how I might approach them and some of the pitfalls that I might already need to be aware of before Tim walks in the door. So for you GPs out there, it is very valuable information for us to know that that Tim is reluctant and that Mum is overbearing and that Tim sees her as being a nag. To be able to confront that early on with Tim would be a very useful part of the engagement process. I'll just change slides. Oops. Okay, so the HEDS assessment tool, I also don't want to go into a great deal of detail about it. I think others are going to be talking about it as well. But I suppose it's another structured clinical interview technique. There's several of them around. The nice thing about the HEDS assessment tool is that it sets out very clearly the important dimensions of what might be happening in the young person's life, and it gives you a platform to have a conversation about what's going on at home, what's going on with their employment and or their education, their activities and so on. And there's plenty of information about this tool on the internet. All you need to do is actually Google HEDS assessment tool and it will come up and actually give you a list of helpful questions and unhelpful questions to ask. It's a great resource. Another way of looking at the assessment process is also to look at the four P's, which is something that's prevalent in CAM services. So we might look at the predisposing factors, the precipitating factors, the perpetuating factors, and the protective factors, which is again, another nice way of structuring your formulation of what's actually going on with the young person. But the bottom line, I suppose, with both of these approaches is it gives you a way of looking at the biological factors, the psychological factors, and the social factors that might be at play for the young person and for their family. So, as Mary said, engagement really is critical. Without it, you don't get anywhere, obviously, and young people are very good at picking up when you're not being genuine. So there's always this tension going on when you're meeting people around about 17, 16, 17, 18 years of age, where in all likelihood they've been dragged along by a parent, or at the very least their parent has been the one who's initiated the contact. So there's this tension between recognising that the young person has some sort of an issue, but it may not be the issue that the parent's bringing them in with, or at least that might not be the thing that they want to talk about first. And, you know, Mary made this very good point that to begin with, to talk about what they actually want to get out of meeting with you is going to get you a lot further than saying, okay, Mum says you're depressed, tell me about that. So engaging and setting the scene, I suppose, that this is a space for them to actually explore their issues, that it's not just a forum for their mother or father or whoever to foist their agenda on them is really important. The other thing that's critical in these sort of scenarios is setting the boundaries of confidentiality. As a 17-year-old, they're entitled to confidentiality, but parents often aren't ready to give that up. So there's that delicate dance again between acknowledging to the parent that you can respect their position, but also working with the young person and creating a space where they feel safe to explore what's going on. And when they walk in the door, obviously you don't know what it is they actually want to talk about. So it's really critical that they feel that there's a degree of safety and that their confidentiality is respected. And I guess that sort of flows on into the other points that I've got there about giving feedback and the art of presenting your view as well. The young person might walk in and say, well, you know, I'm not really depressed, I'm just angry, I'm irritated. You know, Mum nags me all the time. And, you know, the school's full of a bunch of dickheads, pardon the language, but, you know, so of course I've fallen out with them. And, well, the teachers are all idiots as well. So they try and present this nice, rational explanation of why they're actually not doing well. And the art, I guess, in presenting back your view might be that, well, depression in adolescence actually often presents like that, that there is this angry agitation, and things like failing at school and losing friends are two of the most common features in young people who are becoming depressed or who are becoming psychologically unwell in other ways as well. And that it's your view that what they're experiencing, while they don't see it as depression, actually fits into something that can be described as depression, and then how you work with that is important. So they might have this perception that if they're depressed, they're going to be morose and under the doona 24 hours a day. And I suppose the important thing is to engage, is to get across the message of what your professional opinion is, but to acknowledge what it is they actually want to work on. So they might say, for instance, in his case, he might actually want to begin by working on issues to do with his mum being a nag, for instance. That might be the most salient thing at that point in the therapy, and it also might be the safest thing for him to work on. As you read through the case study further on, it obviously gets into issues that sound like hallucinations, potentially. It gets into cyberbullying as well. These are layers that take time to get down to, and you, in the initial sessions, you're not necessarily going to get down to them without a greater level of trust first. So this is where, I guess, the probing deeper becomes important, exploring a little bit about, you know, okay, Mum's a nag and we're dealing with those issues, so what are some ways you could work with your mum to actually mitigate those sort of problems? But then turning your attention to, so what is actually going on at school? You know, obviously, yes, your mum, you know, let's agree that your mum is a nag, but she's she may have a valid point here. Why do you think the your friendships have dropped away, and why do you think your marks have deteriorated as well? And getting into a bit more of a dialogue about what actually might be going on there can be very valuable, and again creates that perception that there's permission to talk about these difficult things. Mary brought that up earlier, permission to talk about suicide. The more, I guess one of the things that I was trained to do very early on with adolescents was, unlike working with adults where you might try and encourage them to explore the options and generate the options themselves, often with adolescents it's very helpful to give them some tangible anchors that they can say, well, yes, it is cyberbullying, or yes, it is that I just can't concentrate in class anymore, or whatever it might be. So instead of opening up the field of possibilities for a young person, you might actually narrow it down to a couple of things that they can work with. And you can use your intuition about what might be going on based on the bits and pieces of information you've picked up along the way. Whenever I hear issues to do with hallucinations and potential suicidality and the question over medication, obviously I'd be very keen to discuss either with a GP or with a psychiatrist what their view actually is. It's again helpful if you've already established with the young person that you believe that they're depressed to then be able to talk about what that might look like, how that might actually develop over time if it's not addressed. So if you go back to the case study, it talks about perceptual experiences that seem a bit like hallucinations. To be able to give them some framework for understanding that is very helpful, obviously. But it is also important to then get a second opinion, I believe, about what else might be going on there. I certainly wouldn't be just relying on my own opinion, particularly in a 17-year-old, because as many of you probably know, one of the times in life when disorders like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder emerge is sort of late adolescence to early adulthood. So, you know, here's a young boy who's right in the thick of that period of his life and is potentially a candidate for an emerging psychosis. So, I think that's all I had to say for now.
That's great, Simon. Thank you very much. Panelists, anything that you want to say at this juncture?
No,
they're all okay. All right. Great pleasure. I introduce Dr. Peter Parry. He is a child and adolescent psychiatrist with the Southern Adelaide Health Care Service, CAMHS actually, Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service, and a senior lecturer at Flinders University. He graduated from Adelaide Medical School in 1983, was a medical officer in the Royal Australian Navy, general practitioner, and worked in palliative care before training in psychiatry from 1990 at Glenside Hospital in South Australia. Since 1995, Peter has worked in both inpatient and outpatient CAM services in South Australia and the UK. He has an interest in mindfulness-based psychotherapy, developmental psychology, and the models underpinning psychiatric diagnosis. And he's published on the controversy surrounding the diagnosis of pediatric bipolar disorder in the USA. We are very interested in your perspective on this. Over to you.
Thanks very much, Michael. And thanks also to Mary and Simon, who, as GP and psychologists, you know, would have, in Tim's case, according to the case narrative that we have here, would have made my job relatively easy in the way that they've been managed to engage Tim and keep Mum on side thus far. I suppose I'd take, I'm not going to go too much into certain key things here, which like the safety issues, because I think Simon's Mary have done a good job around that, and I did get the feedback from the first edition of this webinar that people wanted me to talk a little bit more about, I think, what I term natural antidepressants. So I'll come to that. But just to say, I think I'd take a slightly different tack, perhaps, with the safety issues in it and confidentiality, and saying up front, as I was developing a rapport with Tim around his normal life and drawing up a genogram and all his interests, etc., that I would say that confidentiality would have a certain limit around safety, that I would have to speak to others if I was very concerned about his safety. As the case history had it here, there was some questions which Simon was alluding to at the end there about this lad. He was hearing voices. And as we, Tim and I, explored these were voices that were occurring in his kind of sleep-deprived state, often late at night when he was heading off to sleep. So hypnagogic hallucinations. They were a critical male voice. And after I had spent a fair bit of time with him over a session or two and heard some more perhaps from his mother with his permission, one got the history of domestic violence earlier in his life and a father who was quite negative and critical. And so one could talk to Tim around the dynamic, psychodynamic meaning perhaps of these. And sometimes I talk to kids like Tim about, well, if you're getting these kind of voices, dissociative hallucinosis stuff we call it, then it often is like traumatic memories, but they're coming through as though you're having a bit of a dream, but you're still awake, and bits of it are coming through while you're awake and this kind of stuff. That's just, of course, I may assess Tim as having other features more suggestive of a true psychosis, and that would take me down a very different track. But in this case of Tim, no, this is a lad who's sleep-deprived, stressed, and somewhat depressed, and these auditory hallucinations, I would put them into that kind of box and be somewhat reassuring towards Tim about those. Also exploring, given the family history of a paternal uncle with bipolar disorder, I asked him, as the case history goes on here, about these so-called highs that have been talked about. This was just him really kind of when he'd had a few drinks that his more disinhibited self, he's been described as a sensitive and somewhat shy kind of lad, but he'd be disinhibited by the alcohol, and that seemed to be really what was happening. And perhaps getting a little bit of a temporary antidepressant buzz from the rising ethanol level for a little while there. And there was nothing suggestive of true hypomania or mania. So, again, reassuring Tim and his mother, who was worried from the family history that there was no bipolar, at least at this stage in his life. And what I would found with Tim was that, you know, this was a lad who his mother had become somewhat enmeshed with him, particularly around the marital difficulties and then the marital separation. And Tim, in essence, had won the Oedipal conflict. He had, like King Oedipus, he'd ended up marrying his mum and killing off his father kind of thing. And no wonder he had this kind of ambivalent, hostile-dependent relationship with her. And he was feeling somewhat rejected, and the loss of his father, who had become quite close to, more close to him between the age of 10 and 13, according to the case history. And then there were stresses in his current life around the falling out with his friend Max, and also problems with a male teacher. And also this girl which he liked, and he was teased about, and the cyberbullying centered on this fact. And so there might come a time in this where I'd be able to feed back the links between the precipitating factors and the predisposing factors about his vulnerabilities towards issues with older or more powerful males, and his issues with this girl and his mother, and ambivalent feelings there. Finding, of course, the right language that, and timing that he could make some sense of that. And what I'm getting at here is actually, what's important is an individualized and meaningful biopsychosocial case formulation that involves those four P's that Simon was talking about. And this is far more useful to me in my understanding of what's going on for Tim than a simple DSM diagnosis that is just phenomenologically based on the symptoms in the here and now and quite decontextualized. So it has to be contextualized And then what you can do is you can feed back to Tim. And what I tend to like to embed all this in is the evolutionary paradigm and how, and give them some idea of attachment theory and rank theory, which play into our species being such a a social species, and where attachment between human beings is very important, and where you're placed in the pecking order and in the tribe is also important. So grief at loss, and also shame and depression when one feels like he did, that he'd been excluded by his peer group and cyberbullied, etc., and was failing at his schoolwork. But it's natural. We're programmed, we're made to actually feel depressed in these contexts. That kind of normalizes, but it doesn't mean that it's healthy. But it starts to give a meaning to symptoms, and then say there might be a way of it's moving out of this state. So that's what I've got here in terms of this slide and the narrative of his life. I just clicked the next slide. This comes from a Professor Jim McKenna of anthropology from Notre Dame University, who was a keynote speaker at a parenting conference here in Adelaide some years ago. And he, in the context of early attachment, was pointing out that we are really hunter-gatherers by genetic inheritance, and the kind of post-industrial lifestyle we're living at the moment causes us problems. So I won't get too lost in philosophy of all of that at the moment. But stay on, Tim. So what I then often do at some point, actually invariably these days, is get to the whiteboard and get out some of the coloured whiteboard markers and give them a little lecture on neuroanatomy, neurophysiology in an evolutionary kind of paradigm. And I make it fairly humorous and obviously choose the language for where they're at. And point out, so I draw a picture of the brain and the nervous system, and I'd point the amygdalas and the limbic system, and this is where your emotions are. This is it's simplified in essence to kind of make it easier. But this is sort of where your moods and your emotions are centered. And I talk about the fight, flight, freeze response, and a lot of the listeners here would know all this stuff, so how the frontal lobes get turned off, and you go into one of those three automatic modes. And then I point to the brain stem and talk about this as the autonomic nervous system. It has two parts, the sympathetic nervous system, or SNS, and also the parasympathetic nervous system, or PNS. And it was pointed out to a medical student, because I would say the stress nervous system, and she said, well, the peaceful nervous system for P, so that you can be in one or the other. And talk about different animals, like a mouse with a cat with a dog, or a Stone Age man with a saber-toothed tiger, and describe it all and act it out a little bit. Then point out that in the modern world, unlike in our hunter-gatherer past, we have stresses and kind of around us in many ways, often vague and often that perpetuate and leave our stress system turned on too long. And so the increasing evidence is that depression is a burnout state, that it is has an inflammatory aspect to it of being in sympathetic or stress system overdrive too much. And Tim, he would understand that because we were able to talk about all the stresses, and this would feed into, as Simon was saying, how he puts the blame on the context in his life. And one can agree with him with that, but then point out that maybe he has got this kind of depressed, run-down, inflamed sort of state in his nervous system. I then point to diaphragmatic breathing and talk about sighing and yawning and laughing and sobbing and how none of us are ever taught these things. And the first time we yawn is actually in the womb. And link that to the Ujjayi breathing of yoga, and that athletes like AFL footballers lining up for goals, and public speakers like Julia Gillard using diaphragmatic breathing. So, my fellow Australians, I'm speaking to you as your Prime Minister using a very slow diaphragmatic breathing technique that keeps my frontal lobes turned on and my amygdalas turned off, and stuff like that. And dogs that use yawning to avoid dog fights, chimpanzees that use yawning to signal there are no leopards so they can all go to sleep, according to David Attenborough anyway. So this is kind of like a whole session, and I get them there. Eventually it ends up with us practicing some yoga breathing. And, you know, they say, oh, I've heard all that, it doesn't work for me. But at the end of being bamboozled with science, they seem to actually give it a go, and I'm having almost 100% success these days with that. Particularly with just coping with stress, but also improving their sleep problems. And so moving right along, and I hope that made some sense to you all, further natural antidepressants about, and there is evidence behind these things, particularly with sleep deprivation, circadian rhythm, the omega-3s in the diet, the need for exercise, vitamin D deficiency, apparently around about half, Mary may know more about this, around half the Australian population and associated with multiple disorders, including heart disease, cancer, schizophrenia, and depression. But kind of embedding this in the evolutionary paradigm about the 17-year-old Stone Age lad, Tim, you know, he was out hunting with the men and the other young lads and the bonding and the rituals and all that, the men's group stuff that went with that, the humour, the sense of success and achievement. So, you know, sometimes, you know, Tim might have had a sport that he had fallen away from, but how it would be good to get back involved with that and all of this kind of stuff. Obviously, of course, when one all the time is working on one's rapport and checking that one's not getting kind of written off, it's a bit of a nut going through this stuff. But I'm not really finding that. This seems to make sense to kids these days. And in fact, there's an article just last month in the American Psychologist, Roger Walsh, who's originally an Australian trained psychiatrist. It's called Lifestyle and Mental Health, and it brings together a lot of the increasing evidence around this area. And he terms them TLCs, therapeutic life changes. Next slide. And then there's the more traditional approaches. So with Tim, there would be, again, I think working in this sort of psychodynamic sense of meaning and narrative, perhaps. Family therapy, as the case history goes on, for those who've got copies and want to read it, you know, it all ends quite successfully because we actually managed to get Tim and his dad in one day, and Dad re-engaged a bit with Tim, which was quite healing, and also liaison with the school teacher that he got on well with. Now, Mary mentioned that antidepressant medications are second line, and those are the current guidelines for severe depression. Often when one sees some psychomotor retardation, they may become first line, but often I would only really use them as second line. But there are the side effects, the increased risk of suicidality and with the agitation effect that might occur in about 1 in 40, 1 in 50. And there's also the issue of withdrawal effects, and that perhaps SSRIs have been underestimated in the past for that. Some problems with spermatogenesis, birth defects, and osteoporosis. So they're not as I once thought they were about 10 years ago and prescribed SSRIs first line a lot of the time, convincing myself that, well, at least they were a benign placebo. But the placebo effect is strong in adolescents. So I try and play that up with the omega-3 fish oil supplements, talking about the balancing of omega-3 and omega-6 and the anti-inflammatory effect of that, and depression being an inflammatory process.
Peter, I'm going to have to wind you up.
Thanks very much, because I've finished just there.
That's great. It's now my very great pleasure to introduce Anne Garden, who provides mental health assessment and interventions for children, adolescents and families within a multidisciplinary private practice in Frankston, Melbourne. She has extensive experience working in the areas of serious mental illness, autism spectrum disorder, family conflict, and with clients who've been the victims of trauma, crime, or childhood abuse. Anne has worked as a mental health nurse in a broad range of settings, including CAMHS, in inpatient settings, and in university, TAFE, and welfare sectors. She holds clinical membership with the PACFA and is credentialed with the Australian College of Mental Health Nurses. And we're looking forward to your perspective.
Thank you. My slide. One of the things that I've done, I've added an extra P to the model. It's the 4 P's model, but I've actually added the presenting problem, so you can call it, you know, the 4 P's plus one, if you like. I actually think the presenting, who presents the problem, who's concerned and who wants the referral, and what they're actually saying is actually quite important. I use the model, this 4 P's or 5 P's model, to think about the intervention that I might put forward to an adolescent or a family. I've worked in CAMHS for a long time, and it's the bread and butter of what CAMHS workers do. I use this model, I've been trying to think about intervention because that's what people were asking for as the follow-up. And even though this is actually an assessment tool, I actually use it as an intervention tool. I'm actually a family therapist, so I think systemically about a lot of the things that I do. And so I've added some statements underneath the P's. So the presenting problem I think is important. From a family therapy point of view, who brings somebody to a therapy session is actually quite powerful. You know, whose problem is it actually? You know, is it, in Tim's case, is it mum's problem? Is it Tim's problem? Who actually feels that they've got a problem? The precipitating factors, you know, why now? And that's, I think, a really important question in child and adolescent mental health. Why not yesterday and why not last week? Why not tomorrow? What's actually happened lately? What's actually facilitated this? And it actually might be what mum said has facilitated. It might be something that Tim says, but it might actually be something else. What are the predisposing factors? You know, why is it this kid? And in a family, he comes from a family of three children, so why is it this one that's suicidal, who's having some sort of hallucinations, having conflict with mum? We don't hear that the sisters are having conflict with mum. You know, what's that about? Is it because he's the only boy in the family? Is it because he's the eldest boy in the family? Because he's got a different relationship than the girls? Certainly, you know, the order of their birth, when dad left the family, if I remember rightly, the story was about the youngest daughter. You know, things fell apart in the family after the birth of the youngest daughter, I think. So, I mean, how old was Tim? I'm not sure how old Tim was at the time, but it depends on his age, his cognitive capacity, the developmental stage that he's at, I actually think are all really quite important. The perpetuating factors, what's the family dynamics? I mean, we know mum and dad weren't getting along very well, and it's only recently that some work's been done on the dyad between the father and the son. But, you know, I'm thinking about what's the relationship between mum and him and he and his sisters and all of that sort of stuff. Is that what's actually perpetuating the problem? Because if some of that is what's perpetuating the problem, then that's where the intervention might need to be. The protective factors, you know, what does this kid actually bring? Because he's trusted the therapist that he's actually seen so far, is wonderful. Not all adolescents trust anybody. Some of the kids that come into my office here, they don't trust anybody and they sit with their arms crossed. And you've really got to work quite hard to engage them. Headspace, you know, is one of those places where kids come in and sometimes they're pretty hard to actually engage because they've seen a lot of people and they might be quite angry. What I actually did, as a family therapist, I actually used Jennagrams not so much as a history gathering tool to stick in a file to get dusty, but I actually used them and developed them with families. So I might have an adolescent and sit with them and say, give me a sense of your family. I don't know them. You know them. What goes on in your family? And, I mean, even with small children, I have a whiteboard in my office and they actually will help draw the pictures when they get the hang of the fact that the girls are circles and the boys are squares. And off they go. They'll actually tell you who's in the family, who's not in the family, who they don't want in the family. I've actually had then grab the whiteboard duster and say, well, I don't want them. You know, they're not someone who I find helpful or who I like. So a genogram's actually a very powerful therapy tool, and it's really not that hard to do. So if we're thinking about interventions with adolescents and what, you know, maybe the family dynamics are something that needs to be worked on in addition to the individual work that Tim's getting, when I drew this genogram, I would hope that as it emerged on the whiteboard in front of the family or in front of Tim, they actually see some of these connections. Because there are three generations of alcohol abuse and family violence. And mum's been subjected to that in her childhood and adolescence. So I wonder what it's been like for her as a mother to deal with a husband who's, who knows what he did when he was drunk, how unpleasant he might have been, and what did the kids see? You know, what's Tim seen? What's his sister's seen? We don't really know what Tim's role has been in the family since mum and dad separated. You know, does mum rely on him too much? Does mum expect him to be a replacement for the male in the family? You know, has he been asked to discipline, you know, his sisters? I find all of those questions quite interesting, and to actually write them on a whiteboard, which is an externalising kind of technique, it actually shows what the problems might be rather than Tim being the problem. Even though Tim's, you know, there looking like the identified problem, the way I look at these things is it's a system, and this boy is a system of those things which he can now see visually. And I actually think doing some of this sort of work perhaps with his mum and his sisters, maybe down the track when he's ready, will show everybody that maybe Tim is not just the problem. He's the one that actually presented for therapy. But there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on in his family. I use this mostly as a therapy tool rather than a history taking. It works as both. So I just added some of these things in terms of you can use family therapy style interventions, and you don't have to be a family therapist. It's really just family centred work. It can be narrative, it can be systemic, and it can be strategic. So to be able to actually do a genogram and talk about it and have them see the problem on the whiteboard, it's actually a strategic intervention that's actually quite powerful, and it can change dynamics in families and change the way people think about themselves and about each other. Getting anybody in a group improves communication. It might help to address some of the systems, the family systems and the attachment issues, because there's obviously attachment issues. Clarifying the family's roles in the family, their strengths and relationships. You know, it might be that some work needs to be done between Tim and his sisters, because maybe he's seen as the dad figure in the family, and so he's actually lost his relationship as a sibling in that subsystem. You know, that this sort of work can be to negotiate and validate the relationships and so on and so on. I think there's lots of trauma in this family, and it may be that the cyberbullying's actually been a trigger for some of the past trauma that's been going on in the family. Who knows what these kids have seen? You know, what angry, nasty stuff's been going on, yelling and screaming when the adults think that the kids are asleep. I mean, kids can't sleep through that stuff. Because I'm very much a family therapist, I think family therapy, but I thought it was important to also think from a mental health nurse point of view, and in terms of who else I might want to be working with and who the team could be. So I've just listed them there. Because I've always worked in the public health system, I've only been in private practice really for the last 10 years. I think very much about access for children and adolescents. They don't have any money, so they actually rely on their parents or somebody to bring them. I think that can have an impact on what therapy can and can't be done. That's why I think Headspace is fantastic, because it's no cost. Therapists who can bulk bill through the NBS system means that Tim can actually come without having to say to mum, oh, you know, can you pay for the session? It changes the whole therapy dynamic about who pays and who brings you. ATAPS, I think, is important. There's new funding for children and adolescents to be able to see through the ATAPS system, and it's not dependent on family income. The Mental Health Nurse Incentive Program, I don't think a lot of people know about that. But for people who are at risk of hospitalisation or have been in hospital a GP can refer to a mental health nurse and people can be seen. Someone like Kim, because his suicidality and his, you know, hallucinations may mean that he's at risk of hospitalisation if there's not the right intervention. A mental health nurse could do some home visiting, could actually do risk assessments. If he stopped coming into the GP, they can be quite a useful role. And a mental health nurse under this program can be involved for, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. It's not time limited. So it's very useful.
And I'm going to have to stop you there. Thank you very much for that insight. Now, look, we've got a small problem with Mary's wireless connection, and therefore she's now still listening, but she's on the phone. But unfortunately, webinar people won't be able to see her, but she can still listen, so that's good. We have been bombarded with questions, and I'm going to start firing them straight away. First question is to Peter. What do you do, Peter, if the young person is hesitant to turn up? So ideally, mum's contacted you, but the kid doesn't want to come.
Well, I think you... So I've never seen the kid at all. It's not after the first session. This is the first session he didn't turn up.
Correct.
Correct. I think one would... I would phone him, or if that was considered too intrusive, perhaps by... I might discuss it with Simon or Mary first up, and if that was considered perhaps not the way to go with this lad, then probably the best thing would be to send him a letter directly. Probably, though, the very first thing I do is just reschedule and see if he'll come to the next appointment.
From my point of view, it would be very useful to have the feedback that he wasn't turning up, and you know, I'd like to find out a bit more about that from Tim myself and see if I could find out what the issue was and support him in getting there.
Any other panel members want to comment on that question?
About how to engage him.
How to engage him if basically doesn't want to come along.
It may be that if he were willing to be seen at home, then a mental health nurse could actually go out and do some sort of intervention then. Or it may be that the mental health nurse actually goes and works, spends some time just having a coffee with mum. If he's at home, he might come out.
And can I just say there's still some old-fashioned GPs who do home visits as well.
Good to know.
Good to know. That's great.
And the other thing is at the headspace I work at, we have an intake process where there's a phone call that's booked. So even if mum rings up to make the initial contact, when our intake officer rings, they was asked to speak to the young person. So often they've had a bit of time to think about it and they're prepared to talk on the phone. And then once they've talked on the phone, they're more willing to come in person. So that's just an advantage of having our processes.
Beautiful. Okay. Well,
sorry, just, I mean, in this case, you know, there is this question of him hearing voices and some suicidal ideation. And given that the GP had a good rapport with him, I'd be on the phone to her, expressing concern that he hadn't come, and certainly, you know, could she do a home visit or find some way of engaging and just reassessing that safety risk. His depression may have worsened. He may be at more high risk.
Okay, beautiful. The next question, which I'm going to throw open to the panel members, is what do you do if mum insists on being part of that consultation had Tim been 12 years old? And I think we'll start with our GP.
if he's 12, I think mum really probably has to be part of it. But I always, I'm fairly assertive with parents, but I like to see them with the young person together first. And I explained from the beginning that my normal practice would be to see the two of them together and then to see the young person on their own towards the end, as long as they're happy with it. There are lots of 12-year-olds that want mum to stay. The more difficult thing with 12-year-olds is when mum wants to talk to you on her own first. I'd be interested with how other people respond to that question as well.
Anyone else?
Yeah, look, I see a lot of this sort of age group, and I often say to them, even younger ones, well, do you know why it is that mum wants me to see you and mum? So I don't actually talk about just the kid. I say, you know, Mum, you and Mum have come. Do you know why this is? You know, do you know what it is that Mum wants? So that, and often the kids will actually say, well, it's Mum's problem. I'll go, gee, well, what is it that Mum's so worried about? So it actually, rather than talking to him about him, I actually talk about the problem rather than the people.
Fantastic. Peter, there have been several questions here on this particular issue, and it's one that I think we all want the answer to. Under what circumstances, what's the sort of burden of disease that would have to happen for someone like you to prescribe medication?
When they're just not getting better and they're getting worse, if there's a degree of... But I think the really important thing is always checking on safety and where a lad like Tim is or any depressed adolescent is with regards to suicidal ideation. And with that, one has to gently explore that ideation, how much of the time it's present, how intense it is, and to how much does it spill over into actual intention. And then are there plans? Has he made threats? Are there attempts that he's actually made? And bearing in mind, you know, that there might be a need to actually have him admitted. Coming back to the medication side of things, I think it's after a few weeks, if they haven't started to get better, I often do end up prescribing. But I'm generally finding that with this kind of so-called natural antidepressant, or according to Dr. Roger Walsh, TLC's approach, plus also the feedback. I mean, we've had a lot of... Everybody's been on the same page here around the importance of a meaningful biopsychosocial case formulation. And it's amazing just when the person themselves can actually understand that for themselves, that I think it helps the narrative self in terms of Stern's different domains of self. You know, the narrative self is, and from self-psychology, helps to organize those kind of deeper aspects of self, and probably at a physiological level reduces stress. So that's an antidepressant effect in itself. So I'm actually finding that I'm not needing to go down the antidepressant path too often. But after a few weeks, yes, I prescribe fluoxetine, probably start 10 milligrams for a week, move up to 20 milligrams, be warning the young person and their family about to look out for agitation reactions in particular, and about some of the more minor side effects such as gastrointestinal and headache and that. But something else I might try before that would be temazepam, and just that Mum or Dad or whoever, you know, has the bottle, and basically three nights a week the adolescent is allowed to ask for, you know, temazepam, 10 milligrams, maybe 20, and just to make sure they get a good sleep, and maybe even to have three nights in a row just to try and really reestablish some good sleep pattern if insomnia and chronic tiredness seems to be a big part of the problem for them. So, yeah, I hope that kind of gives some impression.
Michael, it's Mary. Can I just, there's a couple of really good resources about the medication question.
Sure.
Headspace has on their website, headspace.org.au, a section called the Knowledge Centre, and they have prepared things called evidence maps, and one of the evidence maps is the use of SSRIs in young people, and it's looking at all the up-to-date evidence, and then it sort of creates guidelines from that. And the other one is the Beyond Blue Guide to Management of Depression in Adolescents. Children and young people. That's the guidelines are quite good there.
And they're obtainable from the Beyond Blue website.
Yeah, and their Headspace website. And the other thing is that the Headspace website has also got a really good overview of the Heads assessment, if anyone's looking at that.
Oh, that's fantastic. Look, a couple of specific questions, and there's one for you.
Mm-hmm.
Are mental health nurses qualified to carry out assessments? Asks one of our webinar.
Mental state assessments, do they mean, or risk assessments?
I guess both.
Yes, yeah, that's what they mostly do. Mental health nurses are trained in specific and quite in-depth mental health assessments and mental state assessment, risk assessment.
Brilliant, okay. Another question that's come through, and that is to all the panel members, How important is Tim's sexuality in such an assessment? And I'll throw that open to anyone.
Very.
Very.
Yeah.
Pretty critical, really. I think we're... was there a specific detail in there about his sexuality? I can't quite recall at the moment, but...
He'd never had a girlfriend, right. But he was keen on this particular girl that cyberbullying occurred.
Yeah. It's perhaps more critical if he thinks he might be homosexual and there's issues about coming out, because obviously that presents a whole other raft of issues. But he, you know, he's obviously struggling with you know, establishing a relationship in the first instance and struggling with the reaction of his peers to that as well. So. I don't necessarily see that as an issue of sexuality so much as maturation, but he's not quite there yet.
Yeah, I'd point out to the person who asked the question that part of the HEDS assessment is in fact the question that goes, many young people your age are experimenting with all sorts of different relationships. Have you had a relationship with a girl, a guy, or both, using gender-neutral language? But as the facilitator, I shouldn't intervene, so I won't. My next question is from an OT. They're just wondering whether or not we feel as a panel that there would be a role for an OT, an occupational therapist, in this particular case.
My feeling about it is that, and as you can see from the slide that I put together, I think an OT can be part of a mental health team. I mean, working in CAMHS, we had psychologists, social workers, OTs, speech paths. It depends on their training. I think the discipline is not as important as the skill base, the tool bag that people actually bring to working with any client.
And I agree with that. I've often worked with OTs as part of the primary care teams I work in, and I think they bring a great pragmatic, functional kind of perspective to when you have case discussions and things like that, and as well as to actually working with young people. And they're often really good at pulling out the kind of practical things that are a problem for the young person that other people might not think to ask about. So I think actually they're very valuable as part of the team.
Okay, that's great. The next question relates to what would happen, Peter, if a GP, say, was dealing with Tim in an environment where there was no psychiatrist available or no early psychosis team. What would the treatment or the actions be in those cases?
I suppose it depends what else is in their area. I mean, there's generally some kind of CAM service covering all parts of the country, and even if it's a visiting service, and they would be able to link back to child and adolescent psychiatrist in a city, and we do have telehealth link-ups, at least in this state.
Could you just explain briefly a little bit about that?
Well, for instance, I cover the Riverland for South Australia, and there's a CAMHS team out there, and GPs, sometimes not particularly au fait with treating adolescent depression, have got a very difficult case, and so we get the CAMHS worker out there on the day urgently. They contact me by phone or email. I discuss the case with them, might organise for the child to be, for the teenager maybe to be admitted to the local Riverland Hospital, and then we organise a telehealth in a few days' time and see the young person and their family and the GP sometimes, and certainly the CAMHS worker, and we try and do it all over the telehealth.
Oh, beautiful. Next question is, what if Tim continues to deny any depressive symptoms and then a few sessions later he decides to stop coming only to spite his mother, who is super involved and almost always asked to see the practitioner first?
some things are beyond our control. It was my first thought. But the other one was, I think you can, I sometimes have very firm talks with parents about how difficult it is to engage someone, you know, and that individuating or separating from the family and becoming their own person is a lot of what this is about, and a way to respect that is to allow them to see me on their own. It doesn't always work, but sometimes it does.
I agree with Mary, and I think, you know, I would follow a similar sort of approach, and if Tim did disengage, probably one of the first things I'd do would be try to talk to him by phone or maybe email, just to see if any sort of connection could be re-established. But if all else had failed, I would probably in the end send him a therapeutic letter, sort of summarising what we've done, summarising what I see his strengths as being, and perhaps talking about a way forward for him, and, you know, how we might go about finding that way forward.
One of the interventions that can be quite useful when you have these kind of mothers is you arrange for her to have some therapy of her own, because then sometimes her neediness can be dealt with and she can leave the child's therapy alone.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I think it just emphasises the need to develop the rapport, the therapeutic alliance with the young person, ahead and foremost from the mother or the parent. Another way is some colleagues just out the back behind me, a service of CAMHS here called YouthLink would deal with the more difficult to engage adolescents, and they do a lot of work through text messaging, and I haven't got the details for you, but they've published a paper on that. Quite a lot of success using texting to keep engaged.
I sometimes think that when adolescents become disengaged, it can be because the family are saying, you know, well, okay, you're now seeing a psychiatrist, you're now seeing a psychologist, so you obviously are the problem. And sometimes I've had kids disengage because they're trying to say to me, listen, you know I'm not the problem, you know it's mum. And so sometimes being able to talk about those things in a careful way can actually re-engage the kids, when you can actually say to them, I actually know that it's other people in your family. It's not just you.
Excellent.
And sometimes young people disengage because they don't need to come anymore, but they can't tell you.
Mm.
They get a job or they've got a girlfriend or whatever, and they can't tell you, so they just stop coming.
Okay, a couple more questions. How is mental health best destigmatised with regards to attending a GP, a psychologist, or a mental health nurse? How would the panel go about doing that? I think I'll ask Simon first.
It's a very good question. I guess I'd be wanting to explore a bit with the individual what their perception of the stigma was, because while you know, there obviously is some stigmatisation in the community about it, each person's going to have a slightly different point of view about what it actually means. So I'd be talking about their concerns about presenting to a mental health service, and I'd be also discussing with them some of the statistics that we saw earlier on, the fact that, you know, 75% of the mental health issues emerge in young people, the fact that 49% of people will experience a mental health issue at some point in their life. I think all of those sort of facts are very important in sort of grounding young people in the facts and helping them to feel a little less abnormal.
Hey, thank you. Peter?
Well, just to reiterate what I've said before, and also to thank Anne's point, I start with a genogram and might spend 20 minutes before come back to talking about the presenting problem. And that's to emphasise what's life normally like for Tim, you know, and all the positives in his life. By that stage, I suppose they see that I'm interested in them as a person, interested in the context of their life. And then, as I've said, when you get the full story and you can feed it back to them, there's a meaningful narrative as to why they've ended up here. And it's not like, you know, they've suddenly developed an illness because they're just bad, and or they were destined for it, or et cetera. I mean, occasionally that is the case, but that's very rare. And so I think that, in a way, dispels the stigma. And having good humour, you know, in the way you discuss things, helps.
Mary.
Yes, I think an important thing is the attitude of the health professional themselves, and I guess I talk to medical students a lot about, with mental health as in any other aspect of health, just realising that there but for the grace of God go I, and in fact maybe I do go there. And, you know, I think it's, especially perhaps for medicine, it can be a them and us situation, you know, that will never happen to me, but if I'm not talking about self-disclosure, but I'm talking about the appreciation that I could be in your shoes, including with mental health problems. And I think that you know, that actually gets conveyed in the relationship between you and the attitude between you. You can call it transference if you want, but I think it is conveyed that I'm not thinking that this could never happen to me.
All right, that's beautiful. Well, guys, we've reached the 7:50 mark, and this is your opportunity for a 3-minute summing up. And since we can't see you, Mary, I think we might start with you.
I don't think that I've really enjoyed the evening, and I don't think I have anything particular to add, but I guess never undervalue the relationship, whatever your discipline. If you can convey to the young person that you are really interested in their situation and you want to see them again, it's important for you to see them again next week or next fortnight or whenever it is, they respond to that. And I'm not sure that it actually matters all that much what you do other than that.
Yeah, would you agree with me that GPs are really the backbone of adolescent mental health care in Australia?
They could be. I'm not sure that that's always the reality, unfortunately, but I mean, there's certainly the people that the adolescent often comes to first if they go anywhere, and I guess my hope is that would be a therapeutic experience for them.
If you had the ability to move or remove just a couple of barriers that exist for young people to access GPs, what would they be?
I think in many places the finances are a barrier. So I guess that was the question that Headspace was probably designed to answer in a way. So to make it accessible in a location that's easy for them to get to without having to rely on mum and dad, not having to have money in order to come, making people aware that they can get their own Medicare card once they're 15, talking about confidentiality honestly up the front of, you know, of the interaction, not to promise things that you can't guarantee confidence around, but also indicating the things that you can. I think, you know, being genuine, I guess.
Okay, that's fantastic. Thank you very much for your contribution. Peter, I know you're going to have to go shortly, so can you give us your summing up, please?
Yes, it's to remember the context, and to show the young person and their family eventually that you're fully aware of the context. It's to find the meaning, the why have they developed what they have, the problem at this point in their life. And I think Anne, you know, she did a great job of all the developmental history and family dynamic factors that one has to consider. I mentioned the lifestyle factors, the evolutionary paradigm, which also one has to consider. And then, you know, never to forget the safety issues and the suicide prevention side of things. So always to keep that in mind. And that then comes back to the strength of the therapeutic alliance, to have a good, solid rapport. And basically when they know that you like them, you want to help them. I mean, it's those kind of very non-specific woolly factors that are probably the most powerful. And the paper that I did mention by Shedler tends to point to that the long-term outcomes from psychodynamic aspects of therapy seem to be the most powerful, in other words, the therapeutic relationship.
Fantastic. Can I just ask you one question in conclusion, and that is we know that psychiatrists are not fabulously distributed across the country. In fact, I believe they're the worst distributed medical specialty in Australia. Is anything being done about that?
You've sprung that on me. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, the economics of things, unfortunately, are that in private practice, going for bigger gaps, there'll be that aspect to it. That will see people like in Adelaide sort of focus on the eastern and inner northern suburbs.
Yeah.
I suppose it comes back to better funding of public health services or much more radical looking at Medicare, where you look at the postcodes and maybe try and get find some incentive, and that goes for GPs too, and all providers, psychologists as well, you know, about trying to get to the areas in the outer suburbs, in South Australia here, you know, we've got Elizabeth in the north and down south and sort of out around Port Adelaide, suburbs that are very poorly serviced, and that's a big political thing.
Sure, okay. Sorry, I sprung it on you.
Michael, can I just say, there's a phone line for GPs called GP Psych Support that the College of GPs and the psychiatrists run together, and GPs can ring in, I think it's a 1-800 number, and or fax or email in a question, and they get an answer within 24 hours. It's of varying usefulness, but it is available.
Thanks very much for that. I appreciate it. Anne Garden, could we have your closing comments, please?
Well, I was just thinking about the lack of psychiatrists. In this area, that's one of the things that's difficult. There's one psychiatrist down here on the Mornington Peninsula who's also the head of child psychiatry at Southern Health. And he's only one person, and he's the only child psychiatrist down here. So a lot of the work that I do in private practice is I work with GPs and paediatricians and myself, and we work as a bit of a trio to be able to manage some of those mental health issues that a child psychiatrist might actually manage. And then when we all panic, then we get in touch with a consultant psychiatrist and ask for his opinion when we've run out of ideas. It's the only way we've been able to manage what goes on down here on the peninsula.
Right. Okay, well, thank
Michael,
you.
Just, I mean, the College of Psychiatrists and the and Medicare have come up with the item 291, the one-off psychiatric assessment that can be done over two or three sessions. And it's so psychiatrists don't just take on patients and then fill up their books. It's about feeding back to the GPs and the mental health nurses and the psychologists, et cetera, and allowing them to get on with it. And then one can do four reviews per year. And so there is an acceptance that psychiatrists are a scarce resource and need to be used more in that capacity within the system at the moment.
Thanks for that, Peter. Thank you. Okay, final word to Simon Kinsella.
I think all of the presenters have made some great points about how to work with young people. I suppose one of the things that I keep referring back to in my own mind is to perhaps be a person first with a young person. You know, young people, I think, find it harder to engage with people who put their profession before the person, and to engage with them, to talk about their strengths and their weaknesses and their interests and all of those kind of normal conversations that we might have with people who aren't our patients are very important to people who are our patients. So you get a greater depth of knowledge, you get a greater depth of connection with the young person, I think, when you do that. And that gives you, I think, much greater capacity then to be the professional second and to follow up with, you know, how you can be an effective helper in this person's life. But, you know, there's plenty of very good points that I think we could reiterate from all the other presenters, but I guess that's what I'd like to finish up with.
Well, guys, I'd just like to thank you all very much for your contribution. Participants, you are encouraged to fill out the exit survey, and you're invited to post comments on tonight's webinar on the online forum in the Mental Health Professionals Network online. We're still getting good at this. We recognise that nothing's perfect, so we'd really like your comments and constructive criticism. Every participant will be sent a link to the online resources that have been discussed tonight and associated with the webinar, certainly within 24 hours. And I'd just like to extend my thanks to the audience for participating. And panel, you were truly magnificent, and I really appreciate the effort. And thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.